This is Tom Roy with radio news from Waveform's WGXC in New York. News about radio waves, transmission art, wireless surveillance, and other broadcast issues from wavefarm.org. The U.S. government reopened for business on October 17th, and that included the Federal Communications Commission, which had promised an application window for nonprofit groups hoping for low-power FM radio stations for their communities between October 15th and October 29th. Instead, the FCC began accepting applications immediately. As of 9:45 a.m. that morning, the FCC's website was in operation. Paul Rimsmandale at Radiosurvivor.com reports that several groups are asking the FCC for an extension for the LPFM application window. Prometheus Radio Project, REC Networks, Common Frequency, and colorofchange.org are requesting that the FCC either extend the date of the LPFM filing window originally set for October 29th by the length of the shutdown plus 1 week, or suspend the window as planned and reschedule it until later in 2013. According to Radio World magazine, at least one LPFM applicant reported a successful filing of its LPFM application on October 17th after the FCC reopened. The FCC also announced that all filing deadlines occurring during the shutdown and up to October 21st are suspended. While the LPFM window was scheduled to open during the shutdown, its deadline is scheduled for after the October 21st limit. Public notice of suspension also says, quote, the FCC asked parties to refrain from submitting filings seeking additional relief until they have reviewed the further guidance that the agency will be issuing, unquote. The FCC also released the sixth order of reconsideration on October 17th, and REC.net goes over it point by point. The FCC has rejected calls for chapters of larger organizations that have full power broadcast holdings to claim the, quote, new entrant, quote, unquote, point. This means that nonprofit groups that don't already run radio stations are not eligible for the low-power FM window. The FCC also denied the concept of secondary selectees, where if multiple applicants in a group of mutually exclusive applications can be accommodated as a result of another member of the group being dismissed, then the other applications can be granted. The FCC said there was no reason to change the rule. The FCC also clarified its protection of translator stations. It clarified that LPFM stations are expected to protect translator input channels on a third adjacent channel, even when the translator is being fed by another translator, a so-called daisy chain. The FCC said it will amend some rules to replace the word primary with input in order to clarify that the protection applies to the channel that the translator actually receives the signal and not the primary station's output channel if they are different. The FCC also clarified the rule regarding LPFM stations operating on third adjacent channels of full power stations. Under the FCC's clarification, they considered the closest fully spaced third adjacent channel station 3 channels or 600 kHz below, and the closest fully spaced third channel station 3 channels above the proposed LPFM channel would be the subject to the announcement. You will not be required to announce a third adjacent channel station if it is located more than 100 kilometers from the LPFM station. And the FCC also once again denied the assignment of LP10 stations and as well as LP50 stations. The LPFM stations will only be 100 watts. Previously, groups had lobbied for reestablishing the former 10 and 50 watt designations. REC Networks says they will continue to lobby for at LP50 in the future. The government shutdown and the lack of any FCC enforcement division for 16 days in October led the SWElling.com blog to report a, quote, record level, unquote, of pirate radio activity. While the FCC enforcement division was off, there were traces online of increased pirate radio activity. The blog reports this past weekend, the North American frequencies often used by pirate radio enthusiasts between 6,920 kHz and 6,970 kHz were packed with pirate radio stations. Here's a recording from October 13th of Radio Paisano. The Federal Communications Commission's Enforcement Division has been shut down completely since the government shut down October 1st, and most of the 1,700 employees of the FCC have not been at work since then. SWElling's guess that pirate radio activity is at its highest levels ever is not backed up with anything more than anecdotal facts, though. The main United States outlet for actual information about pirate radio activity is the FCC, which is not providing any at the moment. You can read more about these stories at recnet.com, radiosurvivor.com, and broadcastlawblog.com. and newsroom.free103.9.org. On Friday, October 11th, Edward Snowden spoke to the public for the first time as he received the Sam Adams Award for his national security leaks. He spoke to the public for the first time through a series of YouTube videos hosted by WikiLeaks.org. Here's Snowden in Russia last week.
This is not about any sort of particular program. This is about a trend in the relationship between the governing and the governed in America that is coming increasingly into conflict with what we expect as a free and democratic people. If we can't understand the policies and programs of our government, we cannot grant our consent in regulating them. As someone very clever said recently, we don't have an oversight problem in the U.S. We have an undersight problem. This is not about any sort of particular program. This is about a trend in the relationship between the governing and the governed in America that is coming increasingly into conflict with what we expect as a free and democratic people. If we can't understand the policies and programs of our government, we cannot grant our consent in regulating them. As someone very clever said recently, we don't have an oversight problem in the U.S. We have an undersight problem. This is not about any sort of particular program. This is about a trend in the relationship between the governing and the governed in America that is coming increasingly into conflict with what we expect as a free and democratic people. If we can't understand the policies and programs of our government, we cannot grant our consent in regulating them. As someone very clever said recently, we don't have an oversight problem in the U.S. We have an undersight problem.
Matthew Lazar reports at Radiosurvivor.com that the Pacifica Foundation has released a request for proposals to run Pacifica station WBAI in New York City via a local management agreement. WBAI has had huge financial problems ever since Hurricane Sandy flooded its downtown offices last October. While the community radio station has never run smoothly, it's never faced a crisis of this sort where it may soon be off the air and someone else will be putting content on 99.5 in New York City. The local management agreement does maintain that WBA must have a studio staffed in part by Pacifica employees and that Pacifica will favor proposals that allow Pacifica to reserve some of the airtime on WBAI for programming produced or selected by Pacifica. The days and times of the retained program blocks are negotiable, unquote. The request for a proposal requires WBAI retain its non-commercial status and adherence to Corporation for Public Broadcasting policies and at least not jeopardize Pacifica's ability to receive Corporation for Public Broadcasting grants. The deadline for proposals is November 6th. Go to Radiosurvivor.com for more information. As the U.S. House of Representatives was voting on October 16th to reopen the United States government, House stenographer Diane Reedy had an outburst on the House floor captured by C-SPAN cameras.
He will not be mocked. He will not be mocked.
Don't touch me.
He will not be mocked. The greatest deception here is this is not one nation under God. It never was. Had it been, it would not have been. No. It would not have been. Constitution would not have been written by Freemasons. They go against God. You cannot serve two masters. You cannot serve two masters. Praise be to God, Lord Jesus Christ.
John Brodkin at ArsTechnica.com reports that Canada may soon require cable and satellite television providers to unbundle TV packages, letting customers choose each channel they want individually. Quote, we don't think it's right for Canadians to have to pay for bundled television channels that they don't watch. We want to unbundle television channels and allow Canadians to pick and pay the specific television channels that they want, unquote, Canada's industry minister James Moore said, according to Reuters. In the United States, Senator John McCain, Republican from Arizona, has long championed channel unbundling and has proposed a Television Consumer Freedom Act, which would not require unbundling but would provide financial incentives to encourage cable and satellite providers to offer channels individually. You can read more about this story at ArsTechnica.com. In October radio history, on October 24, 1970, President Richard Nixon asked radio broadcasters to screen songs containing lyrics that promoted drug use and not air them.
If I should choose to make a part of me, but surely strike me dead. And now I'm one toe over the line, sweet Jesus, one toe over the line.
On October 27, 1920, Westinghouse radio station in East Pittsburgh, KDKA, began broadcasting. On October 27, 1947, You Bet Your Life with Groucho Marx premiered on the ABC radio network. The show later moved to NBC. Here's the opening of a 1958 episode.
Hey, George, you tell us, what is tonight's secret word?
Ladies and gentlemen, the secret word is name, N-A-M-E.
Really?
You bet your life. The National Broadcasting Company presents Groucho Marx in You Bet Your Life, the comedy quiz show transcribed from Hollywood. Groucho meets our first contestants in just 1 minute.
Hello there. This is Leo DeRocher. You know, I've seen a lot of baseball in my time, and most of it from somewhere on the infield. From the minor leagues in Atlanta and St. Paul as far back as 1925, right through the majors, as a shortstop and as a manager. Played with and against some of baseball history's all-time greats. Now, when you've spent so many years at a game, you're bound to know it inside out and backwards and forwards. You kind of have a feeling for how things are going to break, even before they break. And you also kind of enjoy sitting down of an evening with friends and talking shop, rehashing the day's doings and trying to call the shots on what might happen the next day. Well, that's exactly what we do every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday night on Nightline. So draw up a chair and join me when we talk baseball on Nightline. Tomorrow night over most of these NBC stations.
And here he is, the one, the only...
Well, here I am again with a chance for each of our couples to win up to $10,000. And if any of them say the secret word, they'll win an extra $100.
Author Douglas Kahn was in New York October 17th to release his new book, Earth Sound, Earth Signal. The book explores electrosonic and natural electromagnetic sounds from the 19th century to the present, tracing the history of radio waves from the Earth and centered around the work of composer Alvin Lucier. A panel of artists and scientists, including Brian DeWan, David First, Anaya Lockwood, Paul D. Miller, and others, spoke at the event and posed questions to author Douglas Kahn. Kahn was introduced by Waveform's executive director, Galen Joseph Hunter, and after his talk was a performance by Suzanne Thorpe and Tristan Shepard. Waveform recorded everything that will be aired November 2nd at 8 p.m. Eastern Time on WGXC 90.7 FM in the Hudson Valley and at WGXC.org and at Wavefarm.org. Galen Joseph Hunter spoke on the phone with Douglas Kahn on October 18th, and here is part of that discussion.
So this is Galen Joseph Hunter, and I'm here with Douglas Kahn, author of Earth Sound, Earth Signal. And we're speaking on the morning following a wonderful book launch event that took place at iBeam on October 17th, 2013. Douglas Kahn is a historian and theoretician of the interplay among media, the experimental arts, and science. He is an Australian Research Council Fellow and Professor at the National Institute for Experimental Arts, College of Fine Arts, University of New Wales in Sydney, working on the project A Natural History of Media. He was formerly the Professor of Science and Technology Studies at University of California at Davis. Douglas's books include Earth Sound, Earth Signal, Energies, and the Earth Magnitude in the Arts, which is published by University of California Press 2013, and Noise, Water, Meat, A History of Sound in the Arts, MIT Press 1999. So Doug, thanks for speaking with me today. I'm wondering if we could start by you talking a bit about the origins or impetus for your research that has led to Earth Sound, Earth Signal.
Well, there's a general origin, and then there was something more specific. I think the more specific came first. In 2002, I was asked to be on a panel at the Society for Literature, Science, and the Arts on a panel called Data Atmospheres, and I decided to look into the work of two people I knew very well, Alvin Lussier, who was my teacher at Wesleyan, and Joyce Hinterding, a friend of mine in Sydney in Australia. And they both did work that involved natural radio. And natural radio is, there's lots of different types of natural radio, but the one in particular that I was interested in were atmospherics and whistlers. Whistlers are sort of the holy grail of natural radio. They are these beautiful little glissandi that are produced by lightning strike that then sends a little signal into up onto the magnetosphere and into outer space and back down to Earth. So if you hear a whistler, it's from a storm in the opposite hemisphere. So these are real Earth magnitude natural radio phenomena. But there's all these other types of natural radio, like this sort of chirping sounds or sliding tones. They have a real musical quality. Anyway, I presented this paper of a couple compositions that Alvin Lussier did and a couple artworks that Joyce Hinterding did, both involving natural radio. And afterwards, after giving the paper, I realized I really didn't know what I was talking about. and that it was, I'd like to have a better understanding of things, and I'm just, insecurity for me is a great motivator. So I started looking into it, and it just sort of, this whole alternative history of many things opened itself up when I started looking more closely. One of the first things that I found was that Thomas Watson, Alexander Graham Bell's assistant, was also listening to natural radio just right after the telephone was invented. And the first telephone test line was stretched across the rooftops of Boston. The telephone line ended up being an unwitting antenna, long-wave antenna. And so at nighttime, he would go and just listen in on the telephone to all these mysterious and beautiful and noisy sounds at night. And so that, you know, all of a sudden this was listening to radio, natural radio, like 20 years before Marconi invented the wireless telegraph. And 10 years, even before Heinrich Hertz proved the existence of electromagnetic waves. So in other words, there was this whole sort of history of electromagnetism, electromagnetic waves, radio, wireless, that was existing at an anecdotal level, not within the usual science or communications history take on things. So that's how I just started looking. In that, I realized also that there was, I soon came to realize that this was an electromagnetic phenomenon, and there was really no good historical take on the cultural incursion of electromagnetism. So I sort of, throughout the book, I had to construct one myself. And that's one of the reasons. There are several others, but that's one of the reasons it took about 10 years to research and write. So that was the specific concrete instance. The other one was that back in 1992 with the book Wireless Imagination, in the introduction I laid out sort of three figures of sound being vibration, inscription, and transmission. And my book from 1999, Noise, Water, Meat, A History of Sound and the Arts, was about inscription. That is, it was about phonography, sound recording, storage, sound film, literature, even writing at a cellular level in William Burroughs's ideas. There were a number of electronic musicians and experimental musicians and sound artists that use sound, electronic sounds, sounds of electricity and things like that. And they told me they'd like the book, but I could never understand why, because I had nothing to say about those those types of sounds. The theory that I laid out in Noise, Water, Meat really couldn't, and the history really couldn't account for electronic music, let's call it. And so that was the other purpose of this, the current book, was to develop that, because almost all histories of electronic music are written as this little parade of technological inventions, electronic music instruments. And then the next layer back is you get the inventors or how they were performed in certain places. But there was really no deeper history of electronic music. So that's one thing I tried to establish. I tried to show that people in the last quarter of the 19th century and beyond were actually listening to electronic music-like sounds for aesthetic purposes, that they were finding pleasure in essentially an electronic music before electronic music.
You said before that you had identified in your introduction to Wireless Imagination three prongs, right? Inscription, vibration, and transmission?
Yeah.
And you said that inscription was your focus in Noise, Water, Meat?
Yeah, so transmission so Earth Sound, Earth Signal has a historical theory of transmission as well. I mean, that's the entire focus.
Right.
I sort of had to come. I'd written something on the composer Dane Rudyard, and that had to do with these figures of vibration. So vibration often has to do with sort of spiritual, even occult notions of resonance and things like that. But in terms of coming out of specific technologies, the inscription being associated with forms of recording and storage like the phonograph or film,
mm-hmm.
And transmission being associated with telegraphy, telephony, and wireless, and then forms of broadcast, and now just the whole infrastructural backbone of global communications has to do with transmission. But it's transmission, but also the electromagnetic waves that first established the modern forms of transmission, starting with telegraphy and telephony and wireless. And so that's I was looking at the arts having to do with all transmissions and some radiations of the electromagnetic spectrum and the way those were generated in terms of natural phenomena and scientific understanding and telecommunications technologies and within different periods of history, specifically the late 19th century, the 1920s, 1950s and 60s in the Cold War, and then starting in the mid-1960s, I get into the artists that started looking at electromagnetism as artistic raw material, and that would be Alvin Lucier, Robert Barry, the conceptual artists, and James Turrell, and Pauline Oliveros, and a number of other people.
The entire interview with Douglas Kahn can be heard Saturday, November 2nd on WGXC 90.7 FM, including the entire presentation at iBeam and performances by Suzanne Thorpe and others. That's 8 p.m. Saturday, November 2nd on WGXC 90.7 FM in the Hudson Valley and wavefarm.org online. I'm Tom Rowe reporting radio news for Wavefarms WGXC. The preceding show was recorded at Wavefarms WGXC in the Hudson Valley in New York State.